With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to WSI-sponsored Pagans Tonight Radio Network. Come explore news, information, entertainment, and ideas from a pagan point of view around the globe. Tune in every night for interviews and lively discussions on current events, philosophies, traditional and not-so-traditional practices, DIY projects, the who's who and what's what of our growing pagan community right here on Blog Talk Radio in English and now in Spanish.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, another Sunday evening on Pagans Tonight and the Pagan Variety Hour. I am your hostess, Liz Hamilton. Hello, one and all. And today we have several very special guests that I will be checking for shortly. The Murphy's Midnight Rounders. Woohoo! Murphy's Midnight Rounders! Yeah! So they have a project that they want to announce to everybody, and they decided to come on our show and do that, and hopefully we can get them what they need. And I think that this is them right now. Area code 952. Hello?
That's us.
Hello. Welcome to the show. How are you guys?
Just groovy. How are you?
Excellent. I am fantastic. I am awake.
I was awake once. I decided to be alert instead.
Yes, the whole alert thing is still coming to me, but that's okay. So, can you introduce us? Can you introduce yourselves for our audience?
I'm Brad Murphy.
I'm Bonnie Hannah Powers.
And I'm Teresa Frank, or Tree.
Okay.
Can you hear us all?
Yes, I can hear you. And
okay,
I'm sure
we're all gathered around a phone.
A phone.
A phone.
That's good. That's good. And yes, I think that you guys are in Minnesota, right?
We are.
That's right.
Hey, what do you know? So am I.
You are too?
Yes, I am. I am in White Bear Lake.
Oh, my God. We're down in Burnsville.
Okay, I have no idea where that is.
Go down 35W. Hang a down on 35W.
Okay. All right, I'll trust you guys because I have no idea what that was.
And yeah, and as soon as you cross over the Minnesota River, you're in Burnsville.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right, well.
Yeah, we're very close.
Yeah, I was just realizing this morning, actually, as I was writing you that email. That I don't know if you guys got or not, but hey, that's okay too.
Email? There was an email?
Yes, there was an email that I was morning.
Oh,
like,
good. I'm
like,
glad we're all prepared.
Right. You know, I was like, oh yes, I'm going to be so prepared. And just as I was about to hit the send button, it went goodbye. Thanks.
Don't you love computers?
No.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
I think computers have actually done something very good for us because it gives us something else to focus on. And with that new focus, now the cats aren't trying to kill us as much.
Oh, yes.
The cats are all trying to kill us.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly. And they're trying to take over your laps as you're trying to use
them. They do that. They do that just to show that they are in charge.
Exactly.
You have opposable thumbs? Put me on your lap.
That's right. Pet me now.
Mm-hmm.
Meow, meow, meow. Feed me now. You should have heard my cat 3 hours ago or so. Oh, my God. Funny. How many cats do you guys have?
In the whole house, 5.
Wow.
Well, they've got 5, and then I've got 1 at home.
Yeah.
Well, 2 cats are ours, and
right.
the other 3 are our roommates.
Right.
Oh,
so
okay.
They're 2, 5, or 6, depending on how you ask the
question.
Yeah,
depending on who you're asking. And whether it's Thursday.
And what?
Never mind. Let it go, Liz.
Okay, let it go. Oh, wow. Okay, so I need to play a short... I'm going to play one of you guys' songs.
Cool.
I Am the Goddess, because I love this song.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
That will allow me to move into the living room with my laptop, et cetera. So we're going to play Murphy's Midnight Rounders, I Am the Goddess. We are here live with the Murphy's Midnight Rounders. Spread the news far and wide. Tell your friends.
Hey.
Yay, Murphy's Midnight Rounders.
Woo!
So here's this really cool, kind of short song. And we'll be back in about 3 minutes.
Goddess of earth and the heavens, I am the goddess of peace and of war. I am the goddess, I'll gather my people under my wing or under my sword. Come worship me in your groves and your circles, come hold me close in your heart and your home. Savage and as part I come in my glory, maiden and warrior and mother and crone. I am the goddess of earth and the heavens, I am the goddess of peace and of war. I am the goddess, I'll gather my people under my wing or under my sword. Outside my protection, why do you turn ancient wisdom and truth? With magic and power and freedom I pledge you, live by the creed I have given to you. I am the goddess of earth and the heavens, I am the goddess of peace and of war, I am the goddess of gathering.
Midnight Rounders, and we are back with the Murphy's Midnight Rounders. Woo-hoo!
That sounded really good over the speaker on our phone.
Yeah, it was. It's actually really impressive. This blog talk radio thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool. It's very versatile, and it's really amazing. I just love it. I love my job.
Now that's the title track to one of our earlier CDs.
Right.
We just finished a couple of newer CDs over the winter, Pearl Street and Sweet Hollow. Now, Sweet Hollow is our pagan CD, and Pearl Street is more folk, Americana,
pagan-friendly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Excellent. And let's see. I have 3 more songs by you guys. I have the Circle Song, One Voice Cries, and Waiting for John Barleycorn.
Wow.
Nice.
So We can play those later.
Right. You need to have some of our new stuff.
Yeah, that's what the email
was
for.
It.
I was like, hey guys, if you want me to play any of your new stuff, just send it to me.
Let me get it.
I can talk to the Witch School people,
yes.
To Tracy and Ed, and we'll get new stuff to you.
Yep,
sounds fabulous, because you guys are just awesome. I was listening to you yesterday when I found out that you guys were, well, I think it was yesterday or the day before. I can't remember.
Said, who are these people? I'd better listen to their music.
Yes, I knew. But I didn't know, like, your names or, like, how long you guys had been doing this or any of your life stories or anything like that. And then I read the press release, and I'm like, holy crap! I'm a fan! And so I guess that kind of, you know, not so subtly segues into you guys needing a van. Holy moly, I can't believe not having a van for traveling.
Yeah, well...
No kidding.
Well, yeah, kidding. I mean, we've got gigs and possible gigs in other parts of the United States, and we need to have a way to get our equipment and ourselves there, and that has been an issue. We had a tour van. It died a slow, painful, agonizing death of meteoric proportions.
Dad wrote a song about it.
I did. It's called Hoopty Blues.
Wow.
Which we will send to you.
I was like, oh my gosh, did we get a live performance on the air? Holy moly, but I'm not going to ask for that. Don't worry. Unless you want to. It's all up to you.
We can do that. You want to hear Hoopty Blues?
Sure, why not? What do you think?
All right, you guys talk. I'll go get the guitar.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. Wow. So we are
Indiegogo.com. We do have a we're trying to raise those funds. We really do need the van. We can't get to our gigs. We are really striving to be professional musicians, but a song doesn't pay a bill. We've tried that. Yeah, AT&T was not happy. They didn't want a song. They wanted money.
Ah, yes. That is...
Respect for the art.
I was going to open this document, but I realized that I can't because this is a laptop and it's not mine, and I don't have the right open office thing to open it with, or else I would post the Indiegogo campaign link for our viewers and listeners. Oh my God, Brendan Tripp is in the house. Thank you, Brendan. He posted it for me.
Very nice. Very nice.
Thank you.
Well, if your listeners want to check out the Indiegogo campaign, it's Indiegogo, Indiegogo.com/ Murphy's Midnight Rounders.
Remember, there's an E in Murphy's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got that confused. I realized that I was spelling it wrong about 3 hours into searching for your music on YouTube. I'm like, why don't these guys have any more YouTube music? There has to be more. What am I doing wrong? And then I Googled Murphy's Midnight Rounders, and they're like, oh, did you mean it with an E? And I'm like, oh.
Oh, as far as YouTube goes, we're still working on that. There's not a whole lot of good recordings of us up.
Although
right now,
we do have access to some new, some video that has been shot over the last couple of years, and we're trying to get that up. Special thanks to a lot of people, Jamie Clemens and a number of people who put these things up.
Yeah, I think it's our PSG show.
Excellent.
Yeah, 2 years ago.
Spirit Gathering Rocks.
So,
is that too loud?
Anyway, we got a song for you, and this is about our van.
Excellent. So let's hear it.
All right. I got them up against the wall. Demon-possessed Hoopty Blues. Got them up against the wall. Demon-possessed Hoopty Blues. Mm-hmm. Now she treats us so mean. Got a heart that can't be true. We'll soon drive a Ford Escort,
a truck or a minivan, but my demon will always start when the devil says can. I got them up against the wall. Demon possessed Oopty Blue. Chug on down the road. Everybody stop and see. And they laugh when they realize it's a car with leprosy. I got them up against the wall. Demon possessed Oopty Blue. Now she treats me so mean. Got a heart that can't be true.
Drive me a Cadillac,
or maybe a Dodge Rammer. Maybe I'll just go out and get me a great big old sledgehammer, cause I got them up against the wall. Demon possessed Oopty Blue. Now she treats me so mean. Got a heart that can't be true.
Yay! That was really good.
Now, they tell me that this is how John and Yoko started.
Well, I would believe it. wow, yeah, I love the Beatles. They're awesome, and Yoko is really cool, too. Gosh, how old is she now? I can't even...
Timeless.
Yeah. Obviously. Let's see.
It took me a long time to wrap my brain around Yoko until I realized that her influence was Japanese folk music.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And that explains the odd and the dissonance. And
Well, what we consider dissonance. It really isn't in Japanese and in many other forms of Asian culture, cultural music. But. To our Western ear, it sounds like dissonance. It really isn't.
Right. Yeah. It's wonderful to listen to music from other cultures. I love doing that.
Yeah.
And she's actually 79. She was born on February 18th, 1933.
Wow.
That's
wild. Wow.
She carries it well.
Yes, she does. And you know, John was just. And the Beatles were just fantastic. I love them. I grew up listening to them. My mom's a huge Beatles addict. Ugh.
Beatles were an early influence in my music, especially the things that John and Paul were writing together. You know, John Lennon and the heart that he had was pretty amazing. And he was a big influence on that, as were people like Stan Rogers, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Moody Blues. I'm a big Moody Blues fan.
Oh, yeah, Brad just wrote a new song. We were just trying to learn it before we called. He wrote a new song. It's called The Ancestor Song. He wrote it for Samhain.
Mm-hmm.
And it seriously has Moody Blues influence.
Now, hopefully... Wow. Hopefully, and I will say hopefully, that's in large, bold letters with quotes around them.
And another
We are going to be able to debut this song at the Witch's Ball coming up at Circle Sanctuary.
Excellent.
So
excellent.
If we can, now that I've put it out there into the universe, I guess the onus is on us, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really now on you. You have a big target on your back.
Exactly.
Oh.
So,
but yeah, we've got we've got new music all the time. We're writing, arranging new music all the time.
That's not a we, honey. That's a you.
Well.
They didn't sing, right.
I try to be inclusive, and look what I get.
No, it's your fault.
It's a wee when he allows us. It's really what it comes down to. Yeah, whenever we have a suggestion, Brad automatically says, No.
Listen, don't be fooled by these two. I'm the one who has to sleep with one eye open.
Yeah, I could see that, but you know, I'm more apt to believe them.
Solidarity.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
You can play this game. I like this game.
No, I don't like this game anymore. Let's try another game.
Let's play I Win. There's only one rule. I win.
Yeah.
Yes, I like that game.
But you have to suggest it, though.
Oh, God. Oh, you guys are great. Wow.
We've got a lot of things going on. You know, the Indiegogo campaign, of course, is a real big of what we're doing. It's a real big part of what we're doing. Sometimes my brain goes faster than my filters do.
Yes, I understand completely. Oh my gosh, you should have heard me last week or a couple weeks ago. I don't have filters this time of night.
Yep.
My kind of woman.
But yeah, the Indiegogo campaign, we're doing new music all the time. We're also branching out doing house concerts as well as the festivals, clubs, pubs, coffee houses, and alleyways.
Any live music venue, we are there. I hesitate to call us a pagan band. We are an Americana power folk band, and we all happen to be pagan.
And so that's going to come into our music, and we want to honor the goddess with our music.
Definitely. And, you know, I applaud you guys like 10 million times over for even attempting to do what you guys do. It's fantastic. And
wow.
I hope
we can do something with it.
It makes the hairs on my arms stand up, and, you know, I just get goosebumps and shivers every time I think of new, exciting, heartfelt goddess center, I guess, or leaning at least, kind of, you know, music.
They're more like listening to port.
Maybe
I think.
Well, Liz, our webpage is mmrmusic.com.
Okay.
There is a link to a player where you can listen to a lot of our music.
Right. We're also on Reverb Nation. We're on Facebook.
I have your Facebook thing URL. Let's see, Murphy's Midnight Rounders. I lost it. Where'd it go?
Well, it's facebook.com/mmrmusic.
No, it's not Facebook.
Yes, it is facebook.com.
Facebook.com, Murphy's Midnight Rounders.
MMR Music.
MMR Music. I'm looking at it right now.
Okay.
You lose. Ha ha!
Story of my life. I thought maybe I'd have a new friend, but no.
Hey, what's your friend? I'll be your friend. We have to get together for coffee or something. We are just close not to
That's
meet.
Cool.
Yes, ma'am.
I go back east. Because, and this is like the big announcement, I guess. I guess I just opened the cat out of the bag. Or opened the bag and let the cat out, as it were. Opened the can of worms, whatever.
You've got me sitting on the edge of my seat.
Yes, I am moving back east to Pennsylvania at sometime during next month.
Oh,
wow.
We're losing
yeah.
you. And I didn't even think that I had you.
I know. I thought I had, like, you know, the greatest and, oh, man, darn it. But, yeah, so there's my announcement, my life. I usually wax poetic a little bit at the beginning of the show about how my life is going and blah, blah, blah. So I guess that's my little life spoof, for today at least.
Well, here's the silver lining, Liz. Here's what we can do. As soon as you get settled in, we'll come out and do a house concert.
That would be spectacular. Oh, my God. Okay, so, guys, here is the deal, okay? You guys need to go to...
We have to have a van.
Yes, exactly. You guys need
to go. Oh, please. Go to Indiegogo.com.
Murphy's with an E.
Right.
If you search Murphy's Midnight Rounders, it will come up on Indiegogo.com.
So go there, donate. They have... $75 in the pot right now, and they got 58 days left on the clock.
Right.
Yeah.
And you need $13,088.
Right. Now, and as soon as it hits that 25% mark, they start bringing it up on their homepage more, so it just rolls along
yeah.
a lot faster after that.
Right.
And let's see, 25% of 13,088 divided by 4 is $3,272, and so they need about $3,200 more. So
we're
calling on you, listeners of Pagans Tonight, and saying give up that latte that you have every morning at Starbucks. You know who I'm talking to.
We want to be able to bring our music to the fans.
Yes. Bloody expensive.
Yeah, and we don't generally differentiate our music. Okay, we're going to go do a show at Fine Line, which is a local club. Oh, well, that means we can't do any of our pagan music. Oh no. We do it.
Yep, absolutely.
You know,
and
I think actually get a kick out of hearing some pagan-oriented music because it gets them asking questions, and they've never heard a lot of it before. So it's a new thing for them, and people do like new stuff.
Yeah, for sure. They do.
I think there's only one instance where we had somebody walk out. Oh, that's when we were in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Yes.
Yeah.
Doing a concert in the park in Sioux Falls.
Yeah, Earth Folk. Here's a shout out to the folks in
Sioux
Falls. Earth Folk. They
Hello, Jonathan and company.
Yeah.
Woohoo!
They arranged a concert in the park. There were vendors and there was rain. But, you know, weather.
I think it was actually snow.
Yeah.
You never know in Minnesota.
An elderly couple wandered up and started listening to our music, and as soon as they realized that we were singing songs to the goddess,
mm-hmm.
they didn't make a scene. They just quietly left.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah,
a little bit of a left turn. One of the great things, too, about the Indiegogo campaign is that if you do choose to make a donation, and we say thank you, if you think about, like, TPT and how they do their prizes with their donations, we're doing a similar thing. So you can get a T-shirt, you can get a bumper sticker,
signed CD,
certain levels. You can get us to come and do a concert for you, and it's great.
And
it's a way to give back.
If you do contribute the whole amount, we will move in with you for 6 months.
Maybe you don't want to do that, but
that's funny.
If you can afford that, you can afford us.
Right.
Are you calling me a cheap date?
Oh, no.
Wow, that's not cheap.
I've already gotten in trouble in this conversation. I'm not getting in trouble anymore.
There again. Don't put the target on your back.
Yeah, I don't think that target ever came off.
No.
No.
Tattooed permanently on my back.
No, it's on the top of your bald head.
It's on my... Thank you so much for bringing that up. You see what I go through? I mean, I have to write music just as a defense. It's like focus on the music. And
yes, and hopefully they'll leave you alone, right?
Right.
Does it work?
No.
It's off.
Well, you get points for trying anyway. Oh, gosh, and we have a guest in the chat room, Afterfav, who is a popular person in the Pagans Tonight listener crowd. Listener
Hi there.
Circle. And he says, if I had the cash, I would keep you at your word. And I guess this will also include, you know, daily playings of what you have, you know, hot off the presses. And,
mm-hmm.
Ilferial also says, I totally would, too. So... Well, there you go.
Is
they don't have
with them?
But they're willing to put you up for 6 months, I suppose.
Oh.
Well, thank you for the compliment. And if you do, yes, we will.
That is so awesome, you guys. Oh, my gosh. House concerts are just really cool, too. I'm a huge fan, and I don't know. You guys probably know S.J. Tucker.
Oh,
Sooj.
Love her.
Yeah. Man, God.
With her, we've shared a couple of different venues with her, yeah.
With absolute ball with her at Paganicon last year.
Oh, yes, Paganicon. Oh.
He just rocked. I mean, that whole bunch, you know, it was amazing.
Oh, here's,
beautiful people.
Here's a band that I don't think that many folks in Minnesota have heard of them. It's Big Bad Gina.
Oh,
oh
love
my goodness. Are they phenomenal.
They're
musicians.
Great.
Yeah.
God, I've got
Yes, serious. I mean, we're talking serious musicians.
We played with them at Heartland outside of Kansas City, and they're just really, really fun. They put on a great show. Check them out. Big Bad Gina.
Big Bad Gina.
When we grow up, we want to be Big Bad Gina.
Wow. Let's see. Big Bad Gina, 3 women, 9 plus instruments, 1 rockin' good time.
Yep.
Oh, and okay.
Yep.
Dance band.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Wow, I'm definitely going to have to listen to them later. What I'm not going to distract myself right now because my brain will go, ooh, shiny, and then I'll forget that I have you guys.
What's the song that's in a hurry. Rhonda? Butch Witch.
Butch Witch.
Yeah.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow. let's see. Oh, what else should we do? Well, I guess I can play another song. Let's see. Oh, gosh, I can't remember your first name.
Brad.
Murphy.
Yep.
Brad.
It's Bonnie, Hannah Powers, Brad Murphy, and I'm Teresa or Tree Frank.
Okay, Bonnie, Hannah, and Frank. Okay. Which is you guys' favorite song, like, out of the four that I or out of the three left that I haven't played yet? The Circle Song, One Voice Cries, or Waiting for Drum Barleycorn? Which one is the most...
you know what?
Waiting.
Waiting for John.
Waiting for John Barleycorn.
No, do you have John Barleycorn or Waiting for John Barleycorn?
Waiting for John Barleycorn.
Waiting for John.
Waiting
Barleycorn.
For John.
Yeah,
Barleycorn.
That okay. Or One Voice Cries. Either
no,
one.
No, Waiting for John Barleycorn.
Okay, we have a consensus, which means I've been overruled.
That's okay. You'll live. You're a man.
Waiting for John Barleycorn. Yeah, I do love that song, and I loved writing it.
Okay, excellent. And so let's go ahead and play that, and then we'll follow up with One Voice Cries, because I like One Voice Cries, too. I listen to all these on, I think on your, somewhere. I think on MySpace or something.
They're on the Reverb Nation and on our website, MMR Music.
Me.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
One Voice Cries. Brad wrote that song for Patrick McCollum.
That is so awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He helped them so much. I loved when Witch School and Pagans Tonight, like, really, and Selena Fox, oh my God, bless her heart.
Mm-hmm.
She's also a host here on our, I can't remember the day. Go to the website and find out. here on Pagans Tonight. So, but, yeah, we kept close watch and helped them, too, and that was just really awesome. So, anyway, let's play Waiting for John Barleycorn, and then I'll go ahead and play One Voice Cries, and then we'll come back. And this
okay.
Will
all right.
Get, you know, fluids for their throat, like me.
all right, we'll talk to you in the next few minutes, then.
Yes, that sounds good. All right, folks, we'll be back live with Murphy's Midnight Rounders right here on PTRN, Pagans Tonight Radio Network. This is Liz. We'll be back.
Papa say, honor comes from everywhere. Cuckoo, man, child, born, even from John Barleycorn. Summer heat drops in the field. Sit back and watch the hoodoo flow. Plantain done in the hot, hot sun. Waiting for John Barleycorn. Thank you.
mighty cold. Oh, bear man, cane in his hand, walked the children singing low ground. Cigar smoke, slapped in hand, calling for John Barleycorn. Son, waiting for John Barleycorn.
Hush now, Papa said. Honor come from everywhere. Kangaroo and child born, even from old Barleycorn.
In the darkness alone, to raise a sound that reaches to the throne. Three share a power and they pass it along. Four sing with one voice that is clear and strong. There is strength in our numbers as we share with one another. There is power together as we stand side by side. We won't stand in the shadows and be silent any longer. Our voice is alive and our fear has died. One voice cries in the darkness alone, to raise a sound that reaches to the throne. Three share a power and they pass it along. Four sing with one voice that is clear and strong. There is strength in our numbers as we share with one another. There is power together as we stand side by side. We won't stand in the shadows and be silent any longer. Our voice is alive and our fear has died. There is strength in our numbers as we share with one another. There is power together as we stand side by side. We won't stand in the shadows and be silent any longer. Our voice is alive and our fear has died.
And we're back after that double feature of Murphy's Midnight Rounders, Waiting for John Barleycorn and One Voice Cries. Yes, today we are live with the Murphy's Midnight Rounders, and we are trying to raise $13,088 for their new van so that they can go traipsing across the country singing awesome songs like those two songs that you just heard.
Thank you. The first one that you played, Waiting for John Barleycorn, we had so much fun in the studio with that. The guy who produced our albums, our last two CDs, Pearl Street and Sweet Hollow, Paul Fariz, he has his own band called Unique Drive, and they are all electronica. This is a totally different type of music than what we are used to, and and he had never done folk music before.
Yeah, he had a background.
So he absolutely rocked it. I so appreciate this man. If you get the opportunity, go out and listen to his stuff, Unique Drive.
Unique Drive. Name of the band. Okay.
And he really kept true to our vocal sound. He stayed so true. When you listen to our recordings, that's what we sound like on stage.
I can't say enough good about him. I just I think the world of him.
Yeah, and trying to keep that rawness was really a challenge.
And at the same time, trying to keep us all from killing each other. Which he did a really good job at, because we're all still alive.
Yes, well, that's a good thing, because otherwise I wouldn't appear on my show unless you guys have some way that I don't know about of getting in contact with people through the interwebs when you're dead.
Well, definitely check out Unique Drive. Check out Rhythm Priest Studios. That's his his studio. And,
okay, and what is this fellow's name again?
Paul Farisi,
okay.
Yeah, just Unique Drive. On Reverb Nation and on Facebook, you'll have it all right there.
Yeah,
excellent. So yeah, that's something that I'm going to take a look at.
Yeah, it was such a joy to work with him because it was all about the music. It wasn't about egos or personalities.
Yeah.
It's about the music.
Yeah,
that is just wonderful. That sounds really like an awesome thing to have because you know so much. I think that it just takes away from the purpose of musicians. When politics and name calling and blah 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 drama, as it were, gets involved.
I agree. There are so many great musicians out there, so many great pagan musicians out there, and they all need a shout out. You know, they all need to know that somebody's listening to their stuff, and we try. We try to listen.
Yeah, you've given a lot of shout outs today. I like that. That's awesome.
You know, people have said, oh, you guys are a great band and so forth, and I really appreciate that. I appreciate the compliments, you know, but there are other bands to listen to as well, and I don't want anybody to get lost in the shuffle.
Yeah.
Right, because I think it's really easy, especially in this really small world that the internet has allowed us to become, to get lost in the internet, as it were.
Yeah, too much information.
Well said.
Yeah, exactly. It's overwhelming. It's incredibly overwhelming with the amount of information that each one of us is given every day. I think I read somewhere the statistic where a person before the internet and before like the modern eras of you know cars and the U.S. mail. mm-hmm. I think that a person's information could cover, like, the front page of a newspaper. Like, their information about other places, like, before they could actually go there. Or
But there is something to be aware of, Liz, and that is that 87.8% of all statistics are incorrect.
Well, there you go.
Made up on the spot.
Made up on the spot, right.
Right. And so that's like the first lesson that I was taught when I was taking statistics in college, and that's that you can make a statistic say whatever you want it to say.
Exactly, exactly. The data is never in question; it's always the interpretation.
Yeah, yeah. How many sigma deviations do you want? We can make it say anything.
Yep. That's really funny.
Somebody got that. I love it.
I think I kind of got that. I'm like, it's still kind of processing. Sigma DVO. Yeah, okay. Uh-huh. Yeah, I kind of get that.
Just regress to the mean and start over.
Yes. oh, goodness. Okay, so we are 15 minutes left. And again, Brendan Tripp has... made me go shiny and forget what I was going to say.
Who's shiny?
Sapient sigmas, he says.
I'm sorry, bro.
Anyway, let's see.
You're breaking up, Liz. Can you try that again?
Uh-oh. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, good. He gave me a shiny in the chat room, and I got lost for a second. But that's typical. So let's see. What else was I going to say? I don't know. Just wax poetic for me, guys. Promote
all
yourself.
Right.
Promote other musicians. Let's hear it. Let's hear your life story.
Once was a man from Nantucket. No, wait.
No.
That one.
How about another family show? How about another song?
You want another song?
Sure.
Okay, yeah. Another song sounds wonderful. Which
one? All right. What do you want to do?
We don't have.
How about Blue Sky? Oh, that's a new one. This
yeah.
one? Okay.
Oh, you tell them.
Blue Sky in the Mountains. It's a brand new song. It's very brand new. It's 4 or 5 weeks old.
Something like that.
And it's mountain music.
We just wrote it yesterday.
Oh, don't lie to me.
Oh, we have some new news.
Yes, Teresa
has
just started picking up a mandolin about a month ago.
Woohoo!
There she is playing her mandolin. So, this one's called Blue Sky in the Mountains.
Blue sky in the mountains where the
Wow, that was really spectacular, guys. That just reminds me of where my dad lives, in the mountains of Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
Oh.
And you can just see, like, sky for miles and miles if you look out over the minus the trees. You can just see sky for just forever. And
well, I was kind of inspired when I wrote that song. We have some people that we love very, very dearly who live down in the Gatlinburg area.
Gatlinburg, Tennessee.
Yeah, a band called Tuatha Dea.
Oh,
and
yes, we have some of their music.
I love everyone in that band. They've been a real inspiration to us and a real encouragement to us, and I just so appreciate them. You know, they were part of the inspiration for that song.
Wow, yeah. that's great.
Yeah. I can hear Becca singing it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and Danny on about four drums behind.
No. He'd have to pick up his guitar for this.
Yeah, he would.
Yeah.
That's awesome, guys. I have enjoyed you guys so much. I wish I had a two-hour show. And then, you know, the second I say that, it's going to be, the onus is going to be on me to,
Exactly. All of a sudden, oh, by the way, you're doing 2 hours this
right.
week.
I'm like, oh, I am?
Oh. I'm not. I'm leaving for Pennsylvania.
Yeah. And it'll be like an hour later there. So I won't have this, you know, nice 9:10 or 9 to 11. It'll be like 10 to 11, 10 to midnight.
You'll have the morning drive time too.
Yeah, okay. mornings. I am a zombie in the morning. Like, today, I woke up at noon, okay?
I totally get it.
We did two shows yesterday. We were at a bar in downtown St. Paul last night, but earlier in the day, we were part of the St. Paul Art Crawl. And we were at a gallery in the afternoon. So we came home between gigs and did face prints in the pillow for about an hour, got up, packed up the car again, and went out. So we actually did two full shows yesterday.
Wow.
So I get the thing about not being up until sometime around noon.
Uh-huh. And that's not even functioning. That's just awake.
Yeah, that's just...
That's crawling toward the coffee pot.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
I have no lurch, give me coffee.
And then I have
with my coffee pot on the stove.
Right.
Because I have one of those one really big cup.
Oh, those are fast. I love those.
Oh, yeah. My mom got it for me before I moved out here a couple of years ago. And she's like, use it well. And I'm like, oh, Mom, I love you. This is what
I prefer an IV, actually.
An IV, I like needles. It was hard enough for me to get a tattoo, which isn't really like, you know,
yes,
needles.
But if you do it before you have coffee, you don't know.
Yes, yes, I do. I do know because needles. I'm the kind that can't take blood without one of those little butterfly needles.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
ream because it just I don't know, just something poking into my flesh. Anyway, okay. So I have a question for you guys. So you guys like live together? Are you a poly group?
No.
No, okay,
no.
Well...
No.
Teresa and I are together.
Okay.
We are husband and wife.
Excellent.
Bonnie lives in another city completely.
In St. Louis Park.
Right.
I'm in St. Louis Park.
Another suburb.
Another suburb of Minneapolis.
I am just very good friends.
Yeah.
Excellent. That is fantastic. I just wanted to ask that because our next...
Because we talked about our roommates, Paul and Jeanette. Yeah. No, they are... We're family, absolutely,
yeah.
But we're not poly.
Okay. And I just wanted to ask about that because our next show, the show following me in about 6 minutes-ish, is waxing poetic about mono and poly.
Uh-huh.
Teasingly called by Brendan and Tripp last week, Monopoly. Huh. And, you know, I encourage you guys to just stick around and listen. They're awesome. Oh, my gosh, we have a caller. Hold on. 312, hello, who are you?
This is one. I'm just waiting for the next hour to pop.
Oh, okay. You pressed the one button and it made the little flag pop up. I'll put you back in the queue.
Okay.
Get back there where you belong. Oh, my God, guys. We have got to meet. Where are you playing in Minneapolis or St. Paul next or near me?
Actually, we'll be at the Amsterdam Bar and Hall on November 13th, which is in St. Paul. We'll be at the Eagles Club in Minneapolis on December 7th.
Uh-huh.
And that's in South Minneapolis.
And at Circle Sanctuary for the Witches Ball.
We'll be at the Witches Ball at Circle Sanctuary.
That's excellent. October 26th.
Right.
Excellent. That sounds really super, you guys. I hope you guys have a wonderful evening. Thank you so, so, so much.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Liz, for having
it's been a lot of fun. Thanks
yes, it was so nice to be had.
Yes, and this is like the first time I'm a variety show. So
uh-huh.
I don't have a theme. I don't have a topic every night like some of the other shows do. I'm just whatever. So Ed kind of threw this one at me, and I was like, oh, yes, yes, let's do it.
spontaneity is
yeah.
fun.
Exactly, exactly. And I am like the queen of spontaneity in the circles that I roam in. At least I think so.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm Sam crazy. So I don't think I'm that crazy, though. Craziness can be so over or underrated sometimes.
You know, if you don't think you are, that's when you have to worry.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'm crazy. I know it. I'm certified and have a T-shirt. So anyway, let's see. We got 3 minutes. What are we going to talk about? We have another caller. Let's see. 310, hi, you pressed the one button. Who are you?
Hi, I'm Christopher Ryan. How you doing?
Oh, hi, how are you? You're the PhD that's going to be on the next show, right?
I called a little early. Sorry about that.
That's not a problem. That's awesome. So here's your introduction, folks, to the next our special guest for the Pagan Science Show, which is coming up in just a few minutes with Ed the Pagan, Alan Salmi, Brendan Tripp, and this gentleman here, Christopher
Ryan.
Ryan, yes, there we go. Wow, I have a brain like a sieve, but that's okay.
I feel like I just walked into someone else's party.
Well,
that's all right. You're welcome here.
One party. We're here with the Murphy's Midnight Rounders, who are a, how do you guys?
Power folk.
Power folk music band.
Cool.
And, so we've been talking music and awesome goddess-oriented stuff for the past hour, and they need the exit here. They need a van for traveling around the United States because they have gigs and possible other gigs in other parts of the country, and they have an Indiegogo campaign, indiegogo.com/Murphys with an EYS, Midnight Rounders, and they need $13,088. And so they are looking for everyone's help.
Please, please,
yeah.
please.
Please, 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 please. I've got my PayPal card right here. I am going on there right now, and I'm giving them my $10 or $5 or whatever I can afford.
Oh,
thank
man,
you
thank
so
you
much,
so much.
You're welcome. You guys are just too
yeah.
fabulous to you know, you're not going to have my help. Of course I'm going to help you. Just what we do.
Thank
you
too.
Know, I can't help myself. and so I think we're going to call it a night here, and I'm going to play something by Tuatha De.
Yeah.
Tuatha De? I can never pronounce those people Tuatha right.
Dea.
Tuatha De, okay.
Which track?
I don't know. Let's see. Let's see which one I have. I have Corner. I have Bagabi. I have Granny's Bedtime Tonic, which is always amusing.
That's it.
Play
yeah.
that one.
You got it, guys. Thank you so much. This is a kind of a long song, so it'll let them get settled in for the next show. And thank you again so much to the Murphy's Midnight Rounders for joining us here on Pagans Tonight. I'm Liz Hamilton. I'm signing off for now, but I'll be back next week with something spectacular. And it's always a great time here, and I love you all so much, and blessed be and good night. For the moment.
don't have an account for Blog Talk Radio, you can get one for free, just for registering. And now, back to our show.
And good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you're at in the world today. And you're listening to another hour of Pagan Science Radio, where we explore the questions that are driving us crazy during the week.
Hi, everybody.
And there you go. And, okay, Alan, go ahead, say hi. As you know, I'm joined, joined by...
Yeah, this is Alan Salmi here in Chicago, one of the Pagan Science Radio hosts, and psychotherapist, astrologer, and a few other different hats that I wear. But this will be a real interesting show tonight because we're talking about monogamy and polygamy and what the right natural state for humans is, if we can even figure that out.
And we're also joined by Brendan Tripp.
Howdy. I was crazy before the question came up, so it wasn't really driving me crazy. I was already there.
Well, it's driving me crazy. And the question, of course, tonight is, we're talking about polyamory versus monogamy. Is there a biological reason for it? Is there something more than just a choice there? And, Alan, why don't you introduce our guest, because I see our guest is already here.
Yes, Dr. Christopher Ryan. Dr. Ryan is a graduate of a PhD program in psychology. He actually studied under the great Stanley Krippner, who, amongst other things, was the psychologist for the Grateful Dead and an expert on shamanism and dream, a number of things. Dr. Ryan lost his wife, who's a psychiatrist, a book called Sex at Dawn, which has been, if you're talking to anybody who keeps up with science and interesting topics, usually they've heard of the book or they've been reading it. And Dr. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Okay, technology grand, we're all here.
Okay, good. Let me go ahead and start the question, and let me start with you, Doctor. We're basically talking about the idea of people being suited for monogamy or people are suited for polyamory or other forms of relationships, and we're asking the first beginning, is there some sort of biological or condition? I mean, is this something we're born into? And that choice.
Well, I mean, I avoid terms like natural and should and all those sorts of prescriptive terms as much as possible because there's so much variation in human behavior. But it's certainly clear that our ancestors lived in a world in which they generally had several overlapping sexual relationships going on at any given time. And so that's what we try to explain in Sex at Dawn. We look at the science indicating the way our ancestors lived. So if you want to view the lives of our ancestors as a template for modern life, then certainly a polyamorous approach to sexuality is more in keeping, you know, more in alignment with the way our ancestors lived. You know, people often say, well, we're not animals or, you know, we've evolved since then and all that. But what they're failing to understand is that human beings evolve culturally much more rapidly than we evolve biologically. So it's true that there have been all sorts of cultural changes, dramatic cultural changes in the last few thousand years. But we still have very deep biological imperatives and appetites that don't change when culture changes. So just like you can say, well, you know, the human diet is completely different. Now we eat, you know, green Jell-O and milkshakes. Well, that's true. But if you only live on green Jell-O and milkshakes, you're going to end up with diabetes and heart disease and all sorts of other things because your body is still referring to the diet of our ancestors. So the more in alignment we can bring our modern lives, you know, compared to the lives of our ancestors, the healthier we are. And that applies to sexuality as well as diet. Sorry, go ahead.
So this is the relationship version of the Paleolithic diet, in a sense.
Yeah, there are a lot of parallels. You know, certainly in terms of responding to people who say, you know, who think that we're born as blank slates and that we can just adapt to whatever our society tells us to do. clearly that's not true. You know, we've been telling adolescent boys not to masturbate for centuries, and they're still doing it, you know. So they're all sort of, we tell adult men and women not to be attracted to anyone other than their spouse, but we're still obviously quite attracted to other people. So there's no evidence that these deep appetites in the human animal are susceptible to rapid cultural conditioning.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that you in your book was you tore a big hole in what you called the standard model, which apparently had been around for quite some time, which was sort of a scientific justification for civilized monogamy, as it were. Is that more or less what they're trying to do?
Yeah, what we call the standard narrative is the story of you know, men always having been obsessed with female sexuality as a way to assure their own paternity of any children that were born, and women always being oriented toward trying to manipulate men into being providers and protectors. This is sort of at the heart of the story that we've all grown up hearing about how men and women have opposing reproductive agendas, and that's why the so-called war of the sexes is unavoidable. And, you know, Robert Wright in his book The Moral Animal even said that it seems that men and women are designed to drive each other crazy, you know, because we've got these two opposing appetites for our sexual lives. But what Casilda and I say in the book is that this is like a dog fight. You know, the dogs actually have nothing against each other. They're just put into this conflictive situation by someone else. And that, I think, men and women, we aren't actually evolved to be in opposition to one another, but we're placed in opposition to one another by a zero-sum post-agricultural world in which women are essentially cut off from all resources. They're cut off from everything they need to exist, food and shelter and protection and all these things, unless they get them through a man. They have to go through a man to get these things. Now, in the last couple of decades, this has lessened a little bit in the Western world, but we still see this playing out in many parts of the contemporary world right now. This little girl who was shot in the head a few days ago in Pakistan for having declared openly that girls have a right to education, for crying out loud, you know, that's still considered a radical position in parts of the world. And so what we're saying in the book is that this opposition, this conflict between men and women is not biological. It's not human nature. It's a result of economic conditions that came about with the advent of agriculture no more than 10,000 years ago, which in evolutionary terms is yesterday.
Okay. Now, Brendan?
Yeah.
You're a long married monogamous man.
Yes.
Okay. What okay, so you've been listening. Do you have questions here?
Oh, you know.
It's okay.
I have issues on the entire subject.
I'm having my sound cut in and out. I'm going to try calling in a different way right now. So I'll be back shortly, okay?
Mm-hmm. All right. Let me go ahead and go ahead, Brendan.
No, you go ahead. I was just...
Okay. Doctor, one of the things I hear a lot about, and people in the community does it, is that this idea that we are allowed to have whatever relationships we want. And for some people, this advocates saying that we have this drive to have even one night stand, especially men. Men just can't help themselves. The idea that men are just so sexually oriented that we will do anything to have sex even one night stand at the risk of relationships. One of the things I hear in a lot of people who are very strongly poly is that the idea is that we want to form relationships with multiple people to satisfy multiple needs, but we would prefer to be a close-knit tribe. We'd like to know everybody who's involved with it. And the idea of being monogamous is that you know this one person's loyal to you, you're that to them, and you own each of yourselves so completely that you you find all of everything that you need from the two of you. And in each of these places, but the one that talks about poly versus being the sort of single swinger life, is any of this driving, is this further biology, or can, is that because we're human that we need to put discipline on this?
Well, you know, people deal with these issues in so many different ways. We very intentionally didn't include any sort of prescriptive information in the book, despite publishers asking us to, because there's no one answer for everyone. There's no way we felt comfortable giving people advice on how to orient their sexual, emotional lives, certainly without even knowing them. You know, so some people prefer the sort of closed system, polyamorous approach that you describe. Other people prefer open relationships. Other people prefer to be single so that they don't really have to answer to anyone. And other people prefer monogamy. You know, and there are so many different gradations in between all those different things. Dan Savage talks about having a monogamish relationship. So it's monogamous, but with the occasional exception, and, you know, everything's negotiated. So there's so many different ways to deal with these things. There's no one approach that makes the most sense for everybody. What I often say in when I give public presentations is that, from my perspective, monogamy is like vegetarianism, in that it's, you know, it can be admirable, it can be healthy, it can be ethical, it can be the right choice in many, many different ways. Our book's not at all an argument against monogamy or an indictment or anything. But the fact is that having chosen to be a vegetarian doesn't mean that bacon suddenly stops smelling good. So, you know, you have to sort of incorporate an understanding of what sort of animal you are into these decisions. So if you decide to be monogamous, that's fine. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But it's important that you do that with an understanding that it's going to be a path with challenges. And so you have to anticipate those challenges. And I think it's important that couples negotiate these things, or talk about them at least, before they past the point of no return, you know, before they've got kids and so much shared history that if they're incompatible on these issues, it's too late to really do anything about it.
Indeed. As a psychotherapist, when I talk to people who are going to be getting married, I tell them, look, have you talked about a lot of these issues, even issues on how to raise children? What are going to be your theories? How are you going to do things between the two of you? A lot of people seem to walk into relationships and have this standard monogamous model and don't have the awareness that there are other options or even consider it. And I think that part of the thing that's been happening lately, especially even just the word polyamory becoming more common, at least people are thinking, wait a minute, we do have some choices here. And that's why I think your book was really important in pointing out, wait, there's more to this than just this, you know, get married for life kind of thing, or get married, get divorced, marry somebody else that we've all seen. So,
yeah, and, you know, we quote a line in the book from the playwright Arthur Miller, who says, an era can be considered over when its basic illusions have been exhausted. And I mm-hmm. think we live in a moment historically where most people recognize that a lot of our basic illusions are exhausted. And one of them is this idea of lifelong sexual monogamy being satisfying for most people. I think most people have seen so many seemingly happy relationships end in divorce because one or both of the partners had an affair. Or, you know, raised by divorced parents, or, you know, we've all had very direct contact with the repercussions of this sort of strict moral code around monogamy. And I think mm-hmm. people are looking for other models. They're looking for other ways to configure their relationships that will be a bit more durable in the face of human nature.
Now, I was wondering, you've gotten I mean, your book sort of dropped in on things and became sort of a general topic amongst people who keep track of such things. I know that you were interviewed, for instance, on Polyamory Weekly by my friend Cunning Minx, and you know, you've probably been on a number of radio shows and things. How has, number one, the academic community taken the book, which is a pretty heavy thesis with, you know, you've done a lot of research and everything there. Are people tearing your ideas apart? Are they saying there's something to this? Are people lining up sides? Are they going to do other research? How's that been?
Well, you know, there's been much more response in the sort of popular press than there has been in academic press, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. But I think part of that is just that it takes longer to sort of filter into that realm, because we're unknown. You know, neither Casilda nor I had published much previously in, you know, peer-reviewed scientific journals or even in the popular press. So I think a lot of people are just sort of like, they have no idea who we are, so they're free to ignore it. But there's been I've been very gratified to see a lot of the response from scientists, even some scientists whom we criticize in the book. Franz Duval, mm-hmm. for example, the great primatologist, who's really responsible for having brought bonobos and awareness of bonobos into the mainstream. You know, we disagree with him about a lot of things, and we criticize some of his thinking very directly in the book.
Right.
And I'll tell you a funny anecdote. I when we were coming to the end of the manuscript, I respect him so much, and Helen Fisher and some of the other people that we disagree with in the book. And a lot of our argument is based upon research done by people like Franz Duval. So, you know, it's a funny position to be in where you're using their research and yet criticizing some of their conclusions. And so I wrote to Franz Duval. I said, look, you know, we're about to publish this book, but my wife and I, my co-author and I, respect your work so much, we really wanted to sort of give you a heads up and give you a chance to read this material. And if you think we're being unfair, or, you know, there's something that you want to disagree with before we go to print, I'm happy to entertain that. And he said, sure.
You were being a real gentleman about it. And that's something that's not often done, I would think.
Well, you know, he's a real gentleman. And, you know, I really respect him. We made the same offer to Helen Fisher. She declined. I guess she was too busy with other things. But Franz Duval said, sure, send it to me. So we sent it to him, and, you know, he wrote back and said, okay, well, I don't know if you've considered this study or that study. And so we had a dialogue for a while, and, you know, basically he was just sort of checking to make sure we knew the literature, and we did. And then he said, well, you know what, you might be right. I don't know. This is very important. These are important questions you're raising, and this is exactly the sort of conversation that we need to be having to arrive at answers to these questions. And I said, wow, that's so kind. Could I quote you saying that publicly? And he said, sure, use it as a blurb on the book if you want. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, so if you look
at
the...
That's how you got that blurb. Yeah.
Yeah, the blurb was originally an email from him, you know, directly. And then I've met him in Casilda, and I've had lunch with him and so on. So to me, like, you know, that's the most important endorsement of all. That's a guy who knows this material inside and out and has every reason to be dismissive of what we're saying, and yet he respects the solidity of the argument we made and the fact that we're just, you know, trying to arrive at a clearer understanding of Homo sapiens. So anyway, that's very important. Sarah Hurdy is another scientist who's work we draw on quite a bit, another primatologist, anthropologist. She's also been very kind and supportive of the book. So there was a critique in Journal of Evolutionary Psychology. That's pretty much the only sort of academic critical response that I'm aware of. And I know the book's being taught in graduate schools and university courses all over the country. So I'm really happy with
Let me jump in here for another question, because a lot of our audience is going to be asking another question. And, man, I did not realize how seriously academically that this has been taken. That's why we have Alan here. Alan's our resident academic. But people are asking me about the one question they ask me between being when they're trying to figure out they have this monogamous relationship and they say, we like it because it's safe and stable.
Right.
And I would love to have a poly relationship, but it doesn't feel safe and it doesn't feel stable. And I always look at it and say, so what's the benefits? Is there, and the health benefits? Or are there other benefits? And they always cite the idea that married men live longer than non-married men.
Or maybe it just feels that way.
But I wanted to offer that as a thing, is that sort of idea that married men live longer than non-married men. I'm not absolutely sure, you know, it's probably junk science. But the idea or not feeling safe or stable in a relationship, and that brings stress.
Well, sure. I mean, it depends on the individuals involved, right? For some people, that safe stability would feel like being trapped and bored, you know? It all depends how you experience it. You know, we've got a divorce rate hovering around 45-50%, so obviously long-term monogamy isn't particularly stable either as an institution. So, you know, again, it gets back to the individuals and what they want. And also these things can change at different points of life. I mean, I know a lot of couples who are in open relationships, or maybe they're swingers or polyamorous or whatever, and then they decide to have children and they just shut everything down and go back to straight up monogamy because, you know, having a child and being pregnant and feeling vulnerable and all the changes that are going on, they decide they just want to do that as a couple, you know, fair enough, whatever. People adapt all the time. Maybe on the other end, you know, kids go off to college and the couple decides, hey, let's open things up now, you know, why not? We don't have to worry about the kids explaining things and all that. So people, you know, even individual couples will go through many different configurations during the course of their lives often. And, you know, so the people who say, yeah, this feels safe and stable, well, you know, it does until it doesn't. You know, maybe I know of people, I'm sure you probably do too, where relationships fell apart because one of the partners said, I have to know other people. I need to meet other people. And the only way to do that is to get divorced. So they get divorced. Well, what if they could have been with other people without getting divorced, you know?
Right. Just understanding that there are more options out there. Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you gotten any flack from sort of the religious community, the more conservative religious community at all? Sort of the culture war phenomena?
No, not really. We've been surprised by that. When we were working on the manuscript, we thought that would be something we'd have to worry about. But, you know, I think that getting back to that quote from Arthur Miller, the basic illusions of our age are exhausted. I think one of the illusions that's exhausted is the idea that religious authorities are reliable source of moral guidance on sexual matters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that what's happened in the last couple of years is that politicians, religious figures, you know, Boy Scout troop leaders, football coaches, everybody who's got an opinion on how we should live our lives sexually has been so discredited that I think very few of those people really want to get into a dispute about the nature of human sexuality. You know, I don't think there are a lot of bishops or priests who really want to even talk about it at this point for good reason. So, yeah, we were hoping to get some, you know, storm and drang from the religious right to just, you know, raise awareness of the book and sell more copies. But unfortunately, we haven't heard anything from them.
Yes,
unfortunately,
that
Unfortunately, that one, when you want them to be out there with the torches and pitchforks, they never show up.
They don't show up. They're like cops, yeah. Never there when you want them.
Okay. Let me go ahead, and we're going to take a moment. Doctor, I hope you'll stay with us just right through this quick little break. When we come back, I'd like to know, you know, what surprised you most in writing the book? I always love to hear what people think about that, but we will be back momentarily.
Have a question? Want your question to be a topic on Pagan Priest? Then send us an email at pagans tonight@gmail.com with the subject title, Ask a Priest, and we'll certainly consider using your question as the topic of our discussion. That email again is pagans tonight@gmail.com with the subject line, Ask a Priest. Thanks for sticking around and tuning in through our commercial break. And now, back to the show.
Okay, just that fast, we're back. Okay. As I was saying, Doctor, is there anything that surprised you in writing the book?
Oh, lots of things surprised me. My God, I had so many, you know, during the anthropological stuff, reading about all these different cultures around the world who think that fetuses are made of accumulated semen. Sorry.
Someone, wow.
You know, those are amazing. There's a lot of the stuff about the war against masturbation and the fact that doctors were masturbating their female patients to orgasm as a therapeutic approach blew my mind. But I think maybe the thing that sticks out most, just that surprised me when I came across it in the research, was the fact that the earliest wife swapping, organized wife swapping in 20th century American culture was not done by hippies, as I would have assumed, or, you know, musicians or artists or some bohemian types, but was actually organized by World War II fighter pilots who were flying missions against the Japanese in the Pacific theater. They had the highest fatality rate of any branch of the military. And in interviews with some of the surviving people from that era, they talk about how what they were doing wasn't just about having a good time or, you know, enjoying life while it lasted, but it was also about forming interconnection between the men and different each other's wives, so that the men who died in battle would know that their wives and children would be taken care of by their colleagues. So that I found that to be very moving and a very direct connection to, I think, what is going on in hunter-gatherer groups, where the sexual interaction isn't just about getting off. It's also about forming very important relationships.
So basically, these fighter pilots formed a tribe of sorts for mutual support.
Exactly. They were depending on each other in the air to, you know, to watch one another's backs. And, you know, they were the literal wingmen, right? And back on ground, they shared this intimacy with one another through their partners, through their wives, as a way of strengthening and maintaining these life and death bonds, you know, and this is exactly what happens in hunter-gatherer societies, where, you know, we go through lots of them in the book, showing how many of them have ritualistic events where you're required to have sex with someone other than your normal partner, and prohibited from having sex with your partner. And this is all clearly as a way of maintaining a greater general level of cohesion in the tribe or the band, and not just splintering off into nuclear families or couples.
What happened to that tradition in the Air Force once the war finished? Did it disappear, or did those people then move it into civilian life, or...
A little of both, I think. I know some of those people started the first swinger clubs on the West Coast, And, you know, and then others probably felt that there was no longer a need for it because the, you know, the danger that they were responding to was no longer an issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine that was a huge surprise to find that out. Yeah, just remarkable.
Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Alan.
Yeah. No, Ed, do you have another question?
I actually do. So I think that was a really big thing. Let me offer a little bit of what our audience looks like. Our audience is made up of largely people who are polycurious, with a handful of real practitioners and a couple of people like Tracy, who have more experience. Alan, who does the psychology for it in our community. So our audience is filled with polycurious people. And the biggest thing that I hear from them constantly is that I really want to do this, my wife really wants to do this, but we're afraid it's going to break up our marriage. Would there be any advice? You too, Alan, on this one. Because I know you do too. Is there any advice that you can offer them to begin dealing with that? And I say, well, you need a psychologist. And they go, well, we don't have money for that. But beyond that, is there any advice there?
Well, the only advice I would offer is that, you know, if a couple wants to do this, both of them want to do it, nobody's being manipulated or forced, and they approach it as something they're doing together, then, you know, it can only strengthen the relationship. You know, and at any point, people can turn back. People can say, okay, this is far enough. I'm not comfortable anymore. And then, you know, they can go and process and figure out if they want to continue or they want to revert to where they were. Or, you know, as I said before, there are so many gradations. That people get this idea that a relationship is either closed or open, like a door. It's either wide open or tight, it's locked shut, you know. And that's not the way relationships really are. I think anybody who's been polyamorous or open relationships in any way will agree that there are so many different gradations. There are even, you know, in a swingers club, there are people who go off into different rooms with lovers. There are people who always are together with their partner. There are, you know, people who only do certain things and not other things. There are all sorts of gradations. So people shouldn't feel that, you know, they have to live up to any expectations or that there's a particular, you know, there's a point they're going to arrive at or something. They just, you know, if people want to explore and they're both interested in exploring and they explore together, then I don't really think there's anything for them to worry about. You know, the danger comes from lack of communication and lack of clarity and motivation, right? If, you know, people in swingers clubs always said when I was interviewing them, they always said, you can always tell when a couple comes to a club like this because it's like their last resort. And mm-hmm. and sure, that will be their last night together probably because it'll throw into very clear relief exactly what's going on in their relationship. So if a relationship is unstable and unhappy, then, you know, this opening it up certainly isn't going to help. You want to do that when you're feeling strong and together.
Mm-hmm. And just to add to that, too, I think that one of the remarkable things now is now that polyamory has started to at least, you know, tug at the mainstream or make itself known, that there's a little bit of that moving into television and that sort of thing. There are more resources out there. I mentioned Polyamory Weekly, the podcast. All of those are on record. Lots of great interviews and things and a lot of good advice. There's a book called Opening Up by Tristan Taramino that talks about the typical challenges that people have. The Ethical Slut is a classic book that has been revised now for more modern times. And there's lots of advice and things out there. Our own Oberon Zell, who along with his wife Morning Glory invented the term polyamory, He's got some videos up on YouTube about polyamory and his observations and things. So I think our listeners who are polycurious, as Ed said, there's a lot of good information out there. And I think, Dr. Ryan, you make a great point in that you can explore and decide what you want and don't want. Trying to remember that you have choices about all this is an important distinction.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, Hello?
You're here.
We're still on. I'm working with a friend right now setting up a website for open, ethically non-monogamous relationships. And one of the things we're trying to do there is to make it a safe place for people who are just curious to come and get information and meet other people and talk about their experience and expectations with no pressure at all and no expectation of engaging with anyone in a way they don't want to. So if anyone listening wants to check that out, it's an alpha stage at the moment. We're not really, it's not a finished up and running site yet, but if you're technology savvy, you're welcome to check it out. It's kotangle.com. That's kotangle.com.
I'm already a member. So, yeah, I saw it. That's been one of your projects. Exactly.
Yeah.
We're audience here. Mm-hmm. Real quick, people out there, 347-308-82222. If you want to call and ask questions, you can. All right, Alan, go back to you.
One of the things that I was also curious about is, have you had much contact now with the pickup artist community? Because there's been this whole trend that's been going on for years. It was more secret on the internet, but then the book came out called The Game and all of this. But what they seem to be working from is that old standard model of competition and everything. And I'm wondering whether your book has made any inroads into some of the people, because there's some very bright people there talking and training people how to connect with others and working with a lot of shy men. And yes, and some of them are real not as ethical in their looking to hook up with people and that sort of thing. But I'm wondering whether there's been any impact or you've heard from any of those folks as a result of the book and the publicity.
That's a very funny question, because tomorrow I'm going paddle boarding with Neil Strauss, who wrote The Game.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. All so right. I don't know if you knew that we were hanging out.
You're
or something.
You know that, right? This is psychics amongst us. Okay.
No, this is the guy that got the New York Times bestseller about this very subject. So how did you connect up with him?
Well, he contacted. It's actually sort of a funny story. When I was writing the book, a friend of mine said, "Oh, you should read this book, The Game. It's really interesting," and yada yada yada. And he told me about. He sort of outlined the book to me, and I thought, you know, that book sounds like it's about playing head games with people, psychological trips to try to, you know, tricks to manipulate people into bed. And that's the opposite of what I'm trying to do here. And so then our book came, I didn't read The Game, and our book came out. And shortly after the book came out, I got an email from Neil Strauss's assistant asking me to be on his radio program. He has a radio program on satellite radio with millions of listeners and all this. And I said no. maybe a year later, I was in Vancouver, and another friend of mine said, "Oh, you should read this book, The Game." And I said, yeah, I've heard about it. It's just manipulation. He said, no, it's Neil isn't one of those guys. Neil is writing about those guys. And it's really a book about his personal journey of dealing with his own insecurities and then meeting these guys and, you know, learning some of the techniques, but also realizing the drawbacks and the inadequacies of these techniques and all that. And it's a much more nuanced book than what I had thought. So then Neil had lunch with a friend of mine, and the friend said, you should meet Chris Ryan. And he said, I tried to meet Chris Ryan, but he refused my invitation. And so it turns out I nagged him, right? I don't know if
right.
It's all about – one of the techniques in the book is that you surprise a woman by not complimenting her on her beauty, or sort of not being as impressed by her as men generally are, and that you get her attention that way. So I guess I did that with Neil. So now we're sort of we've spent some time together. But he's a very, very smart guy, and through him I've met some people in that community. And it's an interesting thing, because really that pickup artist scene is all about that's just about getting someone into bed, but there's nothing about what to do with them afterwards. So
yeah, there's actually a few of those pickup artist teachers have started to expand their courses into, okay, now that you've got the relationship, what do you do with it? But of course, that's not the flashy thing that you hear about.
Well, if you're interested in more of that, I've got a podcast that I just launched 2 weeks ago, and the first episode is an hour long interview with Neil Strauss. So if anyone wants to hear Neil and I talking about this stuff, the podcast is called Tangentially Speaking, and it's up on iTunes, and you can also get it at feralaudio.com, feralaudio.com, and you'll see Tangentially Speaking there. So, yeah, there's an hour-long conversation where I do say to him, you know, what do you say to people who accuse you of just teaching, you know, men how to manipulate women, right? How do you respond to that?
And how can we find how can people make contact with you on your website really quick?
The website is sexatdawn.com.
That's real easy.
Yeah, easy to remember. And there's a contact form there. People can contact me directly, and there are excerpts of the book and all the end notes of the book for people who download or get the audio version, for example. They don't get the end notes, so they can get them all on our website. They don't have to go out and buy another book.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very nice of you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of important information in the end notes. My editor felt the narrative was a little too cluttered with interesting, you know, tangents. So he convinced me to put them all in the end notes. But my natural style is to be tangential. I like going down tangents. So that's why the podcast is called Tangentially Speaking.
It looks as though this book and getting the book out has been a real adventure for you. Meeting all sorts of different people, winding up talking with other researchers or people in the sex positive community, and running into folks like Neil Strauss and whatnot. You know, Ed asked what was a surprise in writing the book. What's been the biggest surprise in getting the book out there and these new directions that you've taken?
Well, yeah, it's been a real adventure. You're right. It's, you know, everything in publishing is such a long shot. You know, it's a long shot that you're even going to get the interest of an agent, and then it's a long shot that your agent's going to be able to sell the book, and then it's a long shot that anyone will read the book once it's published. And, you know, everything seems to be a one in a million shot. And so, yeah, we're very gratified that any of this has happened, much less that it's happened to the extent that it has. I've been really gratified by how generous people have been. You know, people who have been dealing with this material for a long time, and then we sort of, you know, wrote this one book and it touched a nerve, and Dan Savage, you know, gave us this huge boost, and that brought it to a lot of people's attention and really got the ball rolling. So we sort of showed up out of nowhere, and people like Susie Bright or Dan Savage or Franz Duvall or Reed Mihalko, or, you know, go on and on and on, these people who have been working in this area for a decade or more, You know, you could see how they might be resentful of us showing up and, you know, getting all this attention. And it's been anything but that. They've been supportive and kind and very, very generous. So we're very happy to be members of this community because they're really good people, I have to say.
Well, it shows that there's a certain amount of power in throwing the monkey wrench into the works of an outdated theory, you know, and really stirring things up, which I think is wonderful. There's one of my favorite quotes is, and I'm not even sure where it's from, is the opposite of courage isn't cowardice, it's conformity.
Right.
You know, and, you know, you're breaking things open for people in a lot of ways that I think are going to be significant over time. I think your book is going to be one of those things that's over time is going to prove itself, you know, and have a very large cultural impact, I think. So.
Well, thanks. Thanks. I hope so. It's we'll see what happens. But so far, I just got the royalty report last week, and the book sold more copies in the last 6 months than it did in the previous 6 months. So that's all due to word of mouth. So it does seem that people are telling their friends about it, and it's a slow burn, but it keeps burning.
Excellent.
Let me jump in here, Alan.
Sure.
We're going to go on a little bit past this because we have some other things to talk about, but after the top of the hour, so that is. Alan, I guess, and Doctor, can we sum this stuff up a little bit for our audience? And thank you so much. We're so honored to have you, and I appreciate you being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's great talking with you guys.
Okay. So, Alan, summing it up, can you help us with?
Yeah, I think that the major thesis in your book, to sum it up, at least one of the things that I had the takeaway from is that really when we were hunter-gatherers, our society, our culture was very different in that we were much more egalitarian, people worked together and all the rest, and obviously, we can draw parallels to some of the shamanic cultures and some of the hunter-gatherer cultures that have still continued to this day. But the thing that really changed humanity, including our sexuality and how we viewed it, was this agricultural revolution where we stuck in one place growing stuff. And your book really showed me how pervasive that change was, not just for our diets and creating civilization, which it really did, but also with how we viewed our sexuality and our relationships as a fallout from that, because people had to figure out what was their land and who inherited and all the rest of that. Would you say that that's a decent summary? I mean, you go so much into depth of the different size of ape testicles and comparative anatomy and bonobos, bonobo chimps and all the rest. But that was sort of my takeaway from it. Would you say that that's a decent summary?
Oh, yeah, that's excellent. That's an excellent summary. I'd give you an A for that.
Ah, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there's so many different aspects of it, but that pretty much sums it up. People, you know, we call it Flintstonization, this tendency to project contemporary conditions into prehistory as a way of explaining and justifying the modern world. And that's a real lack of imagination there, because in fact, pre-agricultural societies are fundamentally different in many of the ways you mentioned that, you know, egalitarianism is very important. In fact, anthropologists call it fierce egalitarianism. So it's fundamentally different to have a society that's built around the notion of sharing versus the notion of private property. And I think that's something that we're still having a hard time dealing with. You know, people who think Obama is a socialist obviously don't really can't wrap their heads around these things.
You know, and actually this could well be another show, because Ed and I had a conversation in a long car ride about the difference in religion and how there's the rebirth of shamanic practices, which is really tied in with this kind of culture, and our modern neo-pagan movement, which is what your audience here is about. Oftentimes our myths and stories are hooked into that agricultural cycle. And this brings up some interesting stuff and some rich ideas on how some of these ideas could even inform some of our spiritual practices and make us look in a broader way, maybe even past our sacred calendar or how to incorporate some other ideas into that.
Yeah, my next book is called Civilized to Death. I'm working on it now. And one of the things I'm looking at there is the difference between monotheistic religion and animist religion. You know, mm-hmm. pretty much all pre-agricultural people are animists. And, you know, it's fundamentally different to believe you live in a world in which pretty much everything is alive with spirit, as opposed mm-hmm. to a world in which everything except us is dead and not, mm-hmm. you know, even animals are considered not quite as alive as we are, not deserving of, you know, the respect and sacred consideration that human beings are. So, that's a very important distinction you're talking about there.
And Alan, you know that I've frequently argued that the shamanic reality is pretty much hardwired into our central nervous system, because mm-hmm. the way it manifests, not in identical patterns, but certainly in general broad strokes patterns from culture mm-hmm. to culture in extremely different environments. I mean, from an Amazon shaman versus
a Siberian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, when, mm-hmm. and you have the inner journeys, et cetera, are very similar across all of these cultures, which is suggested to me, at least, that it's something that is really hardwired into us, and that returning to a shamanic awareness is pretty much getting back to the basics, and all the rest of it's just window dressing.
Right. Dr. Ryan, have you looked at the works of Daniel Quinn in regards to animism and that sort of thing?
Sure. Yeah, I read Ishmael, and I think we refer to it in Sex at Dawn. I haven't read his other books, but
The story of B, I think you will really like, because he puts things in a much more academic way in some of the lectures that he puts in appendices in the back of that novel. I highly recommend that as another. It's a very succinct argument for animism, actually.
Oh, good.
But when do you expect your book to come out? Is this a 10-year project, or is it something you can look forward to next year? Or?
I hope not. The deadline's April 1st for the manuscript, so unless I completely blow by that deadline, it should be out in early 2014, I think.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, we'll be looking for that, definitely, because I'm sure a lot of people in our community will be interested in what you have to say about that. Just as I hope that being on the podcast now will get them looking at your other book, too.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on.
Excellent.
And thank you. And so, Alan, why don't you go ahead and describe, give all the information out one more time, and then we got to talk about something that happened today that was really cool. And this has been a really good show. Thank you, Doctor, again. Mm-hmm. So who have been talking? So for the final thing.
Let me summarize here. This has been Dr. Christopher Ryan. He's co-author of Sex at Dawn, which is a book all about the evolution of human sexuality, which he wrote with his wife. Got to give her some credit with it, too. And if you're interested in more information on his projects, sexatdawn.com is one of his major websites. His podcast is Tangentially Speaking, which you can get on iTunes and at Feral Audio, FERALAudio.com. Also, a website that's still in alpha testing for people interested in talking about relationships and exploring them in a non-monogamous or more open way, or just struggling with some of these issues, is Kotangle, KOTANGLE.com. Dr. Ryan, thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. Really, really appreciate it.
This my pleasure.
This has been really excellent. Thank you,
Mike. My pleasure. Thanks, all you guys.
Mm-hmm.
And now I've been itching to talk about this since the show began. So, but this was such a cool guest. If you want us to continue, if you want to know what we're talking about and have cool guests, you can let us know at pegasnight@gmail.com. Now, for you guys who are not going to stay on past the hour with us, so we're going to talk a little bit. We're going to talk some more science stuff right after past the hour. But next week we're going to talk about the science of Ouija boards. I guess it's time. It's Halloween. People are asking us about the science of Ouija boards. And Brenda, you've had some experience with Ouija boards, right?
I've had a certain amount, yeah. I've not touched one in, I don't even want to say how many decades. But I actually have read, you know, I keep pouring books into my head. I've read quite a lot of it. And one of the things that I found very interesting is a concept that the Ouija board connects with a very, very low level spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you are connecting with the spirit, but it's, you know, it's, it would be like in a noir cop drama or something like this. The Ouija board spirits are like the real low-end street informants in one of these noir cop shows. You know, it's this, the lowest of the low, and they may have a little bit of information, but they're going to really play you to get whatever they can get out of you to get that information. And this really struck me as fairly accurate for what's going on with the boards.
So I'm going to stop you right there.
Okay.
This is for next week.
Okay.
See, this is just a sample.
Well, you ask me.
So hang on to that sample, and we'll have more. I'll be fascinated to hear about that from you, Brendan, and I'll be able to chat a little bit about some of the science behind it, in the sense that there are some things from hypnosis that could inform us on some of these movements and things like that. So I think this will be a fun show next week.
Absolutely. Now, what I really want, and now we'll get into this, I want to congratulate Felix Baumgartner. Okay, this is right up there. Roswell, New Mexico, this guy, for 5 years he prepared for this, and I was watching it. I actually ended up not going down to the plant, which is what the other thing I wanted to talk about, is I opened up the plant this week. And I have things to ask people, but this guy jumped from the edge of space from 128,100 feet.
That first step's a doozy.
It was. And he starts spinning out. And
24 miles down.
Just a remarkable, remarkable feat. You know, and I don't care whether it was Red Bull that put the money into it. I think it's just so cool that he pulled this off.
Well, I want to talk about that, too. I think the important thing about this is that this was a non-NASA project.
Yeah, I was just mentioning to somebody earlier this evening, it's been a really good month in that, because they had that restocking mission up to the space station on private a private mission, and then this being a private mission.
Well, yeah, I would be the second coolest thing this week was the Dragon X piece, the rocket that got there.
Yeah.
And even if that would not have been as cool, you know, there was another thing that was cool this week. The Curiosity mission picked up its first rock this week, and they said it was a lot more complicated than they originally thought it was going to be.
A lot of space news, yeah.
I mean, so any one of those things in any given week would have been a major story.
Mm-hmm.
I unfortunately was on the couch when I was watching that, and that endless checklist of stuff put me to sleep. And so I missed him going out of the capsule. I woke up when he was about 30 seconds from hitting ground. Which so
right.
Well done. It'll probably be on YouTube.
Yeah.
Oh, it's more than that. You can go right to the Red Bull, and let me give Red Bull their due. Just go to the Red Bull site. They have it all on the Red Bull site. At the best of the film, they're saving for themselves. So go right down to Red Bull.
I was looking at the shots of that control area and it's like I'm sitting there saying, what smartass decided to put that in Roswell? So I'm sitting there. Probably the happiest person in that room was the PR director for Red Bull, saying, oh, God, we don't have to explain why he's a greasy spot on the scenery.
Absolutely.
Well, one of the other things that I don't think people have talked much about was the fellow who was in communication with him from the ground.
Had the previous record from the early 60s.
Only he had the previous record, and that was like 30, 40 years ago. So is this much older guy. And I remember an interview saying, I want him in my corner because he's the only one that can understand what I'm going through. And I thought it was just wonderful that he was there supporting him, cheering him on. And, you know, I had read something about something like this from Popular Science a few years ago, and where they were talking about what are they going to do if they have to ditch something from space?
Right.
And that this is a step in, you know, what would happen if one of these private shuttles runs into problems and we've got to get people out. Is there a way that they could actually parachute down to Earth? And you know, this is an important step in that direction. So there's good science behind it, too, not just a big stunt.
So let me make this even cooler, This is actually a lot cooler than people think. And because we're the Pagan Science Show, we're going to tell you what it is. Do you know that today was also the 65th anniversary of the day that the U.S. test pilot Chuck Yeager was the first person to officially break the sound barrier in a jet?
Yes.
And not only that, but Yeager today was up in an F-15 Eagle as they broke the sound barrier at 30,000 feet. Around California's Mojave Desert. So 65 years ago, the first time we broke the sound barrier, and today was the day that a human being broke the sound barrier.
Did he actually break it? Because the last thing I saw, they were still trying to figure that out.
Hi, guys.
No.
It depends on who you're asking, but the officials aren't going to do that for a couple of days. They're going to make absolutely sure. Of course, they're going to give us some pins and needles.
Mm-hmm.
But supposedly 833 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So even if they drop it a lot, it's still, you know, they got plenty of room.
On the news, I had heard that he had done Mach 1.2 was one of the estimates. So, yeah, he broke the barrier.
I'd be fascinated to know what it was, if there was any effect around him. As you see these shots of planes as they're breaking the barrier, and like there's this big halo of like mist around them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if anything weird happened around him as he's breaking Mach.
Mm-hmm. Well, keep in mind, Brendan, that the only way that he could get up to that speed is that there was so little air. He was really in space. It's the air that's going to slow him down. So some of those air effects wouldn't be showing up, but maybe they would in minor ways. I mean, there's still molecules of air up there extremely thinly. That's why he was in a spacesuit. But I hope this guy writes a book about this because it would be fascinating.
Oh, I think they will. I think there's going to be a documentary around this. But let me offer you this. So it was the highest a balloon has ever gone. The highest balloons on hand, man. There have been a lot of other breaking. But let's talk about the other side of this, the social media thing it broke. Do you know it broke the record of 8 million simultaneous live streams at its peak?
Wow.
And that's a record?
That's a record. Incredible. 216,000 likes, 10,000 comments, and 29,000 shares in less than 40 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I'd been reading about this for, you know, I get the free Red Bull magazine, I think it's what, the Bulletin, and they have covered this, obviously, rather extensively in previous issues, and, you know, they're pretty sharp on the social media stuff, so I'm, you know, it's hardly a surprise that they were leveraging that.
Even NASA was congratulations to Felix Baumgartner and Red Bull Stratos on record-breaking leap from the edge of space.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to bring this around to I moved into my Pegonix plant.
Yay.
And we moved there with the earthworms.
Worms are
so
us.
I've been talking to a group called Mars One, which is doing the reality show about trying to put people onto Mars. And It looks like we're talking to them on a very serious basis about becoming a sponsor of theirs. But more important than they become a sponsor of us, about putting worms on Mars as part of this overlapping show. So, So the space industry is really beginning to heat up. So, this is an amazing thing. But we talk about, Brendan, you just blew this off. Okay, but I want to take you to task. You just blew this off saying, Red Bull is they're just really on top of their game.
Well,
You didn't move past it. I mean, come on. People work at this a lot.
Well, yeah. I mean, but I've been in marketing communications all of my life, and so there's a certain. As I said, literally, when they were having all those people, cheering and crying and hugging each other, and I'm sitting there trying to pick out, okay, which one's the PR director who's so relieved right now the guy didn't die. and literally that was what was going through my head. It's like, okay, I bet it's that tall gal there. There isn't like a lot of enthusiasm. It's more relief. I said, I bet she's the PR director.
Right, because they have to figure out what to say if something doesn't happen.
Oh,
just
yeah,
like
I
Nick
mean, this would have been pretty icky for them if the guy ended up going splat.
And he did have a bad few minutes in the opening. He started spinning like they were afraid of, but he got himself under control.
Mm-hmm.
And they were – hi, guys, it's Liz. Jumping here with some interesting information that I learned when I was watching it this morning. They used a new kind of space suit technology.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys talked about that earlier or not. I didn't hear you guys talk
about
it.
Go ahead.
They had like little wing things like underneath of his arms, and if you look really close, that's how he stabilized himself. He basically brought himself under control using those. So
say Red Bull gives you wings on them?
Yes, Red Bull.
Thank you very much.
he wouldn't have lost a shot like that. No.
And this guy, I was watching and I was just thinking through my head, what is this guy thinking? He's crazy. I have never heard about this before today. And my friend goes, oh, yeah, I can't Skype with you right now because I'm watching a guy about to jump from space, from outer space to Earth, 23 miles up. And I'm like, what? So, of course, I was instantaneously on my Twitter and being like, okay, what the heck is this guy even thinking? But it's just incredible, and it broke so many records today. Oh, my God. Like, 4 records were just shattered out of the water.
I think the old guy still had one of the records because I think his fall
was longer.
Was longer by, like, 15 seconds or something.
No, almost a minute and 10 seconds.
Minute? Really?
Oh, wow.
A minute and 46 incredible. Minutes, yeah.
That's incredible. What else was I going to say?
So he must have had more air friction or something to keep him in free fall longer by that amount.
It's
probably
the new suit that they used. Mm-hmm. And they have that capsule now. I think somewhere it said that they successfully retrieved it. And they're going to do all kinds of analytics and stuff with the data that it brought back. And this is the next step, man, in the words of Neil Armstrong, one step for a man and a giant leap for mankind.
I did see the step of when he's going off of the edge of that, and I said that first step's a doozy.
Yeah, I know. I heard you say that, and I just laughed.
mm-hmm.
It's incredible watching the whole thing. But they were smart. They put it on a 20-second delay.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't actually live. It was 20-second delayed in case something happened.
Right.
So they could cut the feed. And I think that's really smart of them because last week, I think it was, somebody killed themselves on live television.
Mm-hmm.
Another head in a live cop chase.
That's happened a few times. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think the amazing thing is that so much of this is now getting public funded and crowdsourced, and I'm just really grateful that Red Bull did this. I mean, it's so wonderful advertising. You know, let me go raise the money, you know, and next time I drink a Red Bull, I'll cheer this guy up.
I think this is making an interesting point, too, that, you know, Robert Heinlein years and years ago had done a speech in which he had talked about how private enterprise was going to be an important part of moving people into space. And I think we're seeing here that now that the government has done all of, in a sense, laid the foundation, done a lot of the hard work and shown that things are possible. You'd probably needed a government to do that with that kind of resources. But now, if you have all of those people moving into private industry, doing things like thinking about mining asteroids and taking some of those folks and working and doing SpaceX and all the rest of that, I think we're going to see a big boom in the space industry from private efforts. You know, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens, and this is yet another example of it.
And it really fills into Ray Kurzweil's increasing speed of technology. Because like I said earlier, any one of those things would have been really cool for us to talk about.
Instead, we get the whole menu of them.
Right. And it's like a whole menu of them. And that's not all of them. I mean, they're not talking about the products that are in there.
Yeah, I had only heard vaguely about this thing about the rock on Mars. I only saw something about that it seemed to have a different quality. It'll be real interesting to get more of the follow up and what the studies are on that.
Right, they're getting surprised. It looks like basically it is a river. They're saying that it is now becoming obvious. I think the thing they're trying to avoid saying is that they're at the bottom, not just of a riverbed, but they're at the bottom of a lakebed. And that these rocks, as far as we know, unless there's a different formula of rock formation on Mars, requires a lot of water. Water was here. And I guess the question, and my son put it best, because he said this, and Liz, let me ask you this question too. My son said, I said, would you go to Mars on a one-way trip? Do you want to be part of one of these cruises? And he says, Dad, they won't pick me for various reasons. He goes, no. What if you could buy your way? He says, he would do it in a heartbeat.
Oh, hell no. I wouldn't do it. No way.
How come?
Okay. I was panicking for that guy when he jumped from frickin' 23 miles up in the air. There is no way you're packing my butt in your spacesuit and sending me into frickin' outer space for God knows how long to get to the surface of Mars. No. It's too much risk for me, okay? I'm a risk taker, but that's pushing it a little far. A little too far for my taste. And okay, so this rock that we're talking about, the rock from Mars that the cam thing found, the results came from two different tools on board the rover. The ChemCam, which uses a laser to probe the chemical content of the sample, and APXS, a spectrometer that can also be used to understand the elemental chemistry of rocks. They've named the rock Jake for short, after this researcher, Jake Metijevic. He was a former chief engineer on the Curiosity rover project who died in August. And so this ChemCam thing picked up high parts of iron and titanium, and other parts of it were high in silicon, aluminum, sodium, and potassium. And it's surprising, the makeup of this rock, because rocks analyzed in past rover missions had different compositions with less sodium and potassium than early Curiosity samples have shown. And it suggests that the area the rover is in is quite geologically different than the regions that we've studied in the past.
Yeah. And potassium and sodium are all water soluble.
Right.
Right. But guess what they just told everybody? Every miner in the world heard what they said. Go ahead and say the first rock we pick up on Mars And this is what Heinlein was talking about. You know, Heinlein in one of his books where they threw the diamonds on the moon to build this up. What are those metals again that they talked about being in it? Their real list?
Iron and titanium.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, did we just say titanium?
And aluminum.
And aluminum.
Yeah.
The first rock we pick up and really analyze has titanium in it.
Yeah.
Everybody who just has ever talked about the space industry just heard the Claxon call of where we're going to put down our first
mine. It just went cha-ching.
Yep. Cha-ching, cha-ching.
I don't know that much about minerals and such. Could you explain a little bit about why titanium is so important?
It's so strong.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the strongest materials that we have discovered. Let's see.
When they talk about spaceships, and a lot of our spaceships have been using titanium, and it's a rare element on Earth. But titanium is what is used to design the spaceships. Titanium alloys, steel alloys, has got about 15 to 20 times the girder strength of the average steel.
A ton of titanium on Mars, and Mars has lower gravity, if we go there and start to mine and find a ton of this stuff, we've got possibilities for really good industry and being able to build ships that would be easier to launch into space with less gravity.
And the other nice thing about titanium is that it's corrosion resistant, including corrosion resistant to seawater, chlorine, and aqua regia, which is nitrohydrochloric acid. It has a low density, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and the thing is, if they found gold, it wouldn't be as precious as this.
No. Oh, no.
It really is Heinlein's story. It is some way in our mythology. Heinlein said this. He said this about the moon, but the fact that that's the first thing we think of on Mars, this valley. But go ahead, Liz. Finish that up for me.
Oh, no. I was just looking through. I'm looking through the Wikipedia for any more little tidbits. Let's see. In its most common compound, titanium dioxide, it is a popular photocatalyst, and it's used in the manufacture of white pigments. Let's see. It can be compounded with iron, aluminum, vanadium, molybdenium.
Molybdenium
or whatever, I don't know. And it produces strong, lightweight alloys for aerospace, jets, jet engines, missiles, and spacecraft. Military industrial processes, which include chemicals and petrochemicals, desalination plants, pulp and paper plants, automotive stuff, agri-food, medical prostheses, orthopedic implants, dental, endodontic instruments and files, sporting goods, jewelry, mobile phones, other applications. It just goes on and on.
Ed, that group that's putting together the consortium to go grab an asteroid...
Yeah,
planetary resources.
Mm-hmm. Right. What's the geological mix on that asteroid that they were specifically? Was it titanium there as well?
No, it was platinum.
It was platinum,
gold, and irons with a lot of carbon and silicates. The volatiles are hydrogen, and they have a bit of hydrogen and carbon in some of the volatiles. But no, they're going after gold, platinum, nickel, the massive amount of nickel. And
we've got a lot of nickel on Earth as it is, but if they can use the nickel up in space too.
Well, no, and the gold is equal to greater amount of gold. If they actually bring down this gold, they'll have the Earth's so the amount of, they will nearly match the amount of gold on Earth.
You know, obviously, if you're going to be building very substantial interplanetary ships, now let's not talk about inter-system ships. We're talking about interplanetary ships. makes a real lot of sense if you build them outside the gravity well.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
And so you get a couple of these asteroids, put them in stable orbits, and build dry docks around them, or whatever the space equivalent of a dry dock is you can build your ships right there, and you're not having to try to push those out of a gravity well.
Right.
Right, right. You know what this makes me think, though, Ed, too?
What's that?
If Mars has less gravity, it's a smaller planet, and if titanium is really strong, do we have finally a possibility of not having one on Earth, but could we have a space elevator on Mars?
I think that's absolutely the way they're going to go. There's no question. It's a lot easier, a lot simpler.
A space elevator? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's where you build you anchor one end of probably a carbon nanotube weave extensively long cable, and you put one on the planet, and you put the other one sufficiently out that it balances, and you put a weight on it on the other end, and it essentially is using the rotation of the planet, pulls the things taut.
Mm-hmm.
And you basically run an elevator.
Put an elevator car.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get from the ground up to space just through something that goes up these cables. And of course, nobody's tried this yet. But the theory is if you put a counterweight on the back end of this thing, the rotation of the planets, like when you're swinging a rope with a weight around it, a weight on the end of it around you, it pulls outward.
Oh, right.
And
okay.
If you have these things balanced just right, the thing ends up not having it's the inherent weight of the carbon nanotube cabling ends up being counterbalanced by the effect of that weight wanting to get swung into space.
Right.
Well, we've had difficulties with the carbon nanotubes, and what I'm thinking is would this titanium be a good enough alloy to create a space elevator on Mars, since we would have less gravitational problems, you know? It brings up some interesting engineering problems.
It also brings up, I think all of this brings up one other thing that tells us as of today. And let me go ahead and take this back into our own worldview, because we're pagans. I think two kind of said this. So I do want to bring this I think it's very exciting. I think it's very much said that. And that is the idea that hasn't this just opened, unless we discover life on Mars, it's a desert. Have we not just unleashed industrialism on Mars? I mean, was there any real limits to what we're allowed to do to that planet?
Well, the very first thing I was thinking, you were talking about this group that wants to move worms to Mars, and it's like, it's foreign biological entities as far as Mars is concerned.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And these issues have already been worked over and at least considered in science fiction. Ed, I know that you've read Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy, and there were people saying in those books it was all about the colonization and terraforming of Mars. And there were people that were very vociferous in, no, we don't want changes. Who are we to say that we should be able to change this planet? Interesting points. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know that we should go putting a lot of people on Mars, because, I mean, just look what happened to this planet.
Right.
It's overpopulated. It's all metal and poison gas and pollution and...
Well, of course, there is the other factor is that if the technological curve keeps going, we are going to have computing systems that are going to be equivalent. My last regular job was doing stuff in Second Life. We're going to have computing systems that are going to be so photorealistic for any kind of input that we wouldn't necessarily have to go to these places. Mm-hmm. I mean, we'd be able to go as a input array
on some floating robot thing that was then putting signals back in our head.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Which certainly makes it easier than flipping these bags of water up into the sky.
Yeah. I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
I think
that's okay, so let me take devil's advocate, but is that person you? Does it matter?
Well, I mean, that does get into that whole, you know, if you're completely porting your intelligence out and then just kind of disposing of the water bag, that is a whole question. Of course, that gets into the whole thing with teleportation. Is the first act of teleportation actually killing the original?
Right, right. And, you know, a lot of those things have come out of things like, I believe there's even a philosophy in Star Trek where they go into the whole thing of, you know, are you the same person that just beamed down to the planet?
Right.
You know?
Yeah, or is it just a duplicate of your physical thing with your memories mapped onto it?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess that kind of brings up the idea, too, of, you know, are you the same person for making a choice? You know, because for me, I'm a total believer in the multiple multiverses, you know, layered on
mm-hmm.
top of each other, because it just makes so much sense that, you know,
right.
each choice that we make puts us in another direction. And, you know, are we the same person for making a choice versus another choice? And
mm-hmm.
did we make the other choice? And are we living another existence somewhere where
right.
we took the other road?
Well, I'm always happy a couple of times a week to come up with the thought that when I pay for a quick pick on the Powerball or the Mega, that somewhere there is every combination is ending up on a ticket somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so every time I'm winning in some reality if I've gone and bought the ticket. And
mm-hmm.
I'm just hoping that that particular mix ends up in the one I'm in.
The other thing, and Brendan can speak of this even more so, is that concept of the self, which is at least another show, and Brendan's own experience and knowledge. I know you have a lot of time in Tibetan Buddhist stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they have an idea that the self doesn't even exist. It's
yeah.
an illusion. So
well,
it doesn't
you know,
matter whether the teleporter brings you one place versus another. You yourself aren't really here.
Right.
You know? So
well,
mm-hmm.
you know, there are two things I was actually going to be bringing up when Liz was touching on that previously. I mean, one, I think it's every 7 years, every cell in your body has replaced itself.
Yep.
And
right.
so you're not the person you were 7 years ago. There is nothing physically there which was there when you were a baby.
Except your DNA.
Well, except the DNA
not
goes
the DNA.
In and out of the cells. It's just everything gets copied. Your big old Xerox machine.
What is, and this is where I saw this marvelous, it was a one-man play where a guy was acting like Buckminster
uh-huh.
Fuller. And he was demonstrating with a long rope that you had a rope and it starts off with one material and then it's spliced and it becomes another material. Well, he moved a knot along that rope and he said, this is a human being. It's the pattern. It's not
uh-huh.
the material.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I was going to be bringing up is that Liz mentioned the multiverses concept.
Yeah.
And that if you look at the multiverses concept, the mathematical probability of a galactic or universal size culture arising in one of them or multiple ones of them is very close to unity, is very close to one. You're going to have this happen. And the odds of a galactic and or close to universal culture developing massive amounts of whatever a higher level computational power is also very close to unity.
Mm-hmm.
In saying, if you have one of these that has developed that, the odds of them doing the equivalent of Second Life on some orders of magnitude massively more complex computing thing, that once you have one of these things, it's going to create its own little miniature universes just for anything. And so, and then he said, and then the odds are there are going to be hugely more of these virtual universes that were created by the computational power of one of these cultures than any of the actual real universes that are populated. And so the odds are very good that we live in a basically a game that somebody's playing in their parents' basement. And
now let me offer you something that most people don't know about me. Well, Sharon this week found out about Cool Row, the clown, out there in the social media world. But no, here's what it is. Not only that, but I'm famous in my Dungeons & Dragons campaign because the character, the main characters of them, called Magus, and then they're called Magus Continuum, absolutely states that Earth and all of this planet is just one manifestation of where the story tells itself. That this is just one manifestation, and that throughout the cosmos, these things are happening. So when you play Dungeons & Dragons, you're actually affecting a real universe.
Yep, and that's why I think they used to say that you shouldn't really play Dungeons & Dragons if you're into the whole magic thing and higher spiritualities, because you can actually bring the stuff out and, you know, create constructs and everything. But, you know, hey, whatever floats your boat, man. I'm not really into the whole Dungeons & Dragons thing, but it's
well, a lot of people got into magic.
Well, one of the things I wanted to bounce back to that whole living inside of a video game somewhere.
Yes.
They have two or three different approaches that people are working on that are showing. One of them was they are accidentally finding this thing in where they're looking for proton decay, where they have these massive, massive tanks of very pure water buried deep underground. And they are finding a granularity in the data that wasn't necessarily expected. However, on the theory that we are in some sort of a computational projection would indicate that there is a pixel size.
Yes.
And that you can't get down past that pixel size, which I think also plays into the whole thing of the Planck time, the Planck length.
Yep, yep.
That you can't get down past these things, and it's like, why?
Right.
Because you've reached that pixel size. And, of course, there is one other incredible argument for that. And if anybody who has spent much time in Second Life understands, there are frequently issues with things not rezzing.
Yeah.
It explains the missing socks.
It totally does.
Because they haven't rezzed. Something went wrong, and that sock that went into the dryer didn't rez coming out.
Oh, my God. You're a genius.
Thank you.
Where do you think of these things? Oh, wait, that's right. You don't have a job. You have way too much time on your hands.
Yes, way too much.
That was mean, Liz.
Well, it's true. I have no filter, okay? It's 11:30. My meds are way out of my system right now, like I was saying earlier on my show. If you want frank, blunt, and highly sarcastic, just talk to me late at night.
And with that, we're going to start wrapping this up. Any last comments from everybody?
I would love it if we would do a show sometime on the multiverses and things like that, and because we could actually do a whole series of them. Because having spent 2 to 3 years professionally living in Second Life, I'm really primed to the concept that we're living in somebody's video game in their parents' basement.
Brendan, how often?
Well, how do you just figure out how to trigger it to make us all rich, Brendan?
Well, that's what we need.
That's the kicker.
Yep.
There you go. Your turn, Alan?
Sorry.
I'm just happy with how things have gone tonight. This has been a very fascinating discussion, both now with the latest news and our previous guest. It's been a blast. And I think I would certainly like any of the people listening
They can email us with other ideas, questions, things that they would like us to cover. We're looking for audience participation here, too, you know. So give us some ideas and give us some feedback.
And you can always call in. And, you know, it's easy enough to Skype Skype into the show. Is it's a button right there on the Blog Talk Radio show site. And, of course, if you're not watching it on Blog Talk Radio, you're missing. It's, admittedly, today the chat room was a little bit dull because we had people. We weren't just blithering. They were having presentations, so there wasn't a whole lot of yak-yak going on there. But usually you're missing half the show because it's going on in there. But there's a little button right on that page that lets you Skype into the show, which is so it makes it easy for you to add your 2 cents worth.
Yep, and I just want to put in my last little blurb for the...
Liz, I'm actually giving you the last word. You have the last word.
Oh, wow, cool, awesome. The ongoing South American book drive is happening, and we're going to make a commercial. I'm going to figure out how to make a commercial and mix it up with some music and stuff, and we're doing a book drive. It can be found, details can be found at facebook.com/groups/CNT books. That's Karelian Nativist Tradition, the initials, books. This is for the Pagan Library that's going to be happening in South Africa next April. And we
South
have...
Mm-hmm.
Yes, South Africa. And did I say something else earlier?
South America.
South America. Oh, dear. Uh-oh. Mm-hmm. South Africa. I'm sorry. I misspoke. So details are at that website, and we have 59 titles so far, I think, something around those lines. I'll have to get the exact numbers for next week.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, email us at...
So you're looking for book donations to be mailed in to that library, and you'll be sending them on to South Africa.
Yes, yes. They're first going to Florida, and then they're going to be sent off from Florida to South Africa sometime in April of next year, probably prior to the lustration that's happening in April in South Africa.
And do you have the address of the site for the van project on Indiegogo?
Oh, yes, I do. Indiegogo, indiegogo.com/Murphy's Midnight Rounders, and Murphy's is spelled Murphys.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about it, guys. I'm really happy to be here, and I'm going to tune in more often, and a lot of fun.
Great.
So, we're dabba-dabba-dabba, that's all,
thank
folks.
Thank you for joining us on WSI-sponsored Pagans Tonight Radio Network. You can hear us every night right here on Blog Talk Radio, or download us later on iTunes. Please check our schedule for accurate show times. For all questions, comments, or show suggestions, you can email us at pagans tonight@gmail.com. And let us know how we're doing. We'd love to hear from you. You can also visit us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on LiveJournal. We invite you to tune in again tomorrow night. Good night, and blessed be.
Wait, you guys haven't got home yet?
All right. Are we off the air now?
No.
I believe so.
No, we're still off the air. We can't hang up to be off the air.
I will press the end episode button.
Okay.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.